today at Reader's Corner, an encore of our talk with Ben McIntyre, author of The Spy and the Traitor, the greatest espionage story of the Cold War. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Ben McIntyre's The Spy and the Traitor was called the best true spy story I have ever read by no less than John Le Carré, the master chronicler of modern espionage. In his book, The Spy and the Traitor, McIntyre tells the thrilling tale of the Cold War's greatest double agent, Oleg Gordievsky. The son of two KGB agents, Gordievsky became the Soviet Union's top spy in the UK, only to become disillusioned with the regime and begin working with British intelligence to foil countless Soviet plots, risking his life again and again. His story is one of unparalleled intrigue, danger, and spycraft. Ben McIntyre is a writer at large for the Times of London and the best-selling author of A Spy Among Friends, Double Cross, Operation Mincemeat, Agent Zigzag, and Rogue Heroes, among other books. Ben McIntyre, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great pleasure, Bob. Thank you for having me.
Well, Ben, you spent enormous amounts of time with Oleg Gordievsky, I think 140 hours of taped conversations with him, interviewing him on more than 20 occasions. You also were able to get information from lots of other people that I thought somewhat unusual. Could you tell us about some of the other intelligence folks that were willing to speak up?
Absolutely. I mean, you're right. I interviewed Oleg dozens of times in the safe house where he still lives. I can't tell you where it is, but this is the house where he is kept safely from potential attacks by his very many enemies who are still around. He lives under a different name. He lives in complete anonymity. He has a permanent bodyguard in attendance. But nonetheless, the intelligence services allowed me to interview him. And more than that, they enabled me to contact all the case officers who had run him as a double agent over an espionage career of more than a dozen years. And that's unprecedented in this country. I mean, that really doesn't happen because MI6 officers, MI6 is our equivalent of the CIA, MI6 doesn't encourage its former officers to speak about what they've done. They have a sort of code of silence, which for the purposes of this book was suspended. And I was very grateful for that. It allowed me to tell the story from multiple points of view.
And how about the KGB officers?
Well, they're, of course, under a different system. But again, I found them more than willing to talk. Obviously, these were colleagues of Oleg Gordievsky when he was in the KGB. They are people who, many of them, feel personally betrayed by him. They have a very different perspective on the story itself. But they were very open to discussing it with me. In fact, many of them produced a great deal of information that was extremely useful to get a very different perspective, because from the point of view of former Soviet intelligence officers, Oleg Gordievsky is a traitor. Mm-hmm. He's not a hero. And so hence the title of the book, The Spy and the Traitor, because, you know, he is both things depending on which perspective you see him from.
So to the question of what makes a spy a counter-spy, what makes a spy turn on his own country, I want to mention three examples, and you can run through these briefly. Berlin Wall, Denmark, and Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, I mean, you put your finger on it there, Bob. There were three signal events in Oleg Gordievsky's life when he was a young KGB officer posted abroad that really turned him against the Soviet Union and convinced him that he was serving a brutal, repressive communist regime that was essentially philistine and illiberal. And the first event was when he was still very young. He was only 19, and he witnessed in East Berlin, he witnessed the building of the Berlin Wall. In fact, they began building it the day after he arrived in East Berlin. And to him, that was a kind of symbolic evidence that Europe was being torn in half. So that was the first thing. The second was his first posting to Copenhagen in Denmark. Now, that was really the first time he'd been beyond the Iron Curtain. And Copenhagen, in what was then the sort of the mid-1960s, was a swinging place. It was a great, free, colorful, exciting, culturally liberal place. And Oleg was just blown away by it. He was and still is a man of high culture, Oleg. And he, for example, he discovered that he could listen to any classical music that he wanted to. He could not do that in the Soviet Union. So that was another head turner. And the third one, and perhaps the most important one, was again when he was based in Copenhagen on his second tour of duty as a KGB officer. It was during the crushing of the Prague Spring in 1968 in Czechoslovakia when the reform movement in Czechoslovakia was crushed by Soviet force. They sent the tanks in and the soldiers in. And Oleg was profoundly, he considered that to be an act of barbarism. And that really did turn him. From that moment on, he was pretty determined to work not for the Soviet Union, but to try to undermine it.
You have a comment in your book that I thought was really interesting when it comes to this issue of trying to get inside the skin of a spy. The decision to spy on one's own country in the interest of another usually emerges from the collision of what you call the outer world and the inner world. How so?
Yes. I mean, there's an outer world of politics, of sort of external influences that clearly had an impact on Oleg Gordievsky. He saw the way the world events were moving. He was able to read Western newspapers. He had a pretty clear grip on the way he thought history was running, and he believed himself to be on the wrong side. So in a way, that is the outer world that I was referring to there. Oleg Gordievsky's inner world is also fascinating. I mean, he was the son of a KGB officer. His brother was a KGB officer. He was born into the KGB. He was brought up in a sort of special KGB compound. And his decision to rebel against that came from a fascinating mixture of motives, really. One was that, you know, he was in some ways fighting his father. He loved his father, but he also disdained him. His father had been deeply involved in some of the more brutal Stalinist aspects carried out by the KGB. So there is a sort of psychology, an internal psychology that is here. Spies often spy for a variety of motives. There is no one shape that fits all. Sometimes it is greed, sometimes it is fear, sometimes it is blackmail, sometimes it is arrogance. In Oleg's case, money never played a part. He never wanted to make money out of what he was doing. He was compelled, I think, by a combination of ideology, anger, a certain amount of arrogance. He did believe that he was going to be able, which he eventually did, substantially impact the Soviet Union. So the inner world of Oleg Gordievsky is a fascinating and complex thing.
Well, that word ideological really comes to mind because clearly he's a great contrast to a spy you mentioned in your book, and you might remind our listeners, Aldrich Ames.
Yes, I mean, that is the central contrast of this story. Oleg Gordievsky not only did not want to be paid, I mean, he specifically insisted that he did not want to become a rich man as a result of what he was doing. He wanted his motives to be and to be seen by his handlers as pure. Now, Aldrich Ames, the CIA officer who began spying for the KGB in 1985, was motivated almost entirely by avarice. Aldrich Ames was disgruntled. He felt he hadn't been promoted properly. He was probably drinking too much. He felt he'd been neglected. But most of all, he wanted a new car. He wanted a bigger apartment. He wanted to live a better, richer life. And so he did it for the money. And boy, paid in the end something like $4.6 million.
And share with our listeners what role Aldrich Ames plays in the life of this career spy, counter-spy, Oleg Gordievsky.
Well, this is, again, the spy and the traitor of the title. In the beginning of 1985, Aldrich Ames made his decision to begin handing what he knew over to the KGB, and he made a direct approach to the KGB in Washington, D.C., and he began to hand over the names of people that he knew were spying against the Soviet Union, the double agents, the traitors, as it were, who were within the KGB, and one of those was Oleg Gordievsky. And within 24 hours of that event, Oleg was summoned back to Moscow. Now, of course, MI6 didn't know what he was being summoned back for. The ostensible reason was that he was going to be made head of the KGB in London, a position to which he'd already been formally appointed. He was going to go back to be anointed, as it were. That was the rationale. But a big debate happened with MI6, and it continues today over whether or not he should go back. And some sense that it might be an ambush, a trap. Others thought that it was a gamble worth taking. And in the end, it was Oleg's own decision, his own personal decision to go back. He decided out of duty that he would take the risk. And very soon after he got back to Moscow, he realized he had walked into a terrifying ambush, the architect of which was Aldrich Ames.
And I want to get to the ambush in a minute, but before we get to that, I wonder if you could comment a bit on just the motif of Gordievsky as a long-distance runner, the consequences of spying, what it does to a person's life and career?
Very few people, I think, emerge from the role of a double agent undamaged in some way or other. And I know it bears the scars of what happened to him and what he did. I mean, the image of the long-distance runner is an interesting one because Oleg took up long-distance running when he was still at university at Moscow State Institute of International Relations, often referred to as the Harvard of Moscow. And he was a very good long-distance runner. He was extremely fit, and there are these wonderful photographs of him pounding along mile after mile. In a way, it is the motif for the book because there is something very solitary about Oleg Gordievsky. He runs alone, if you see what I mean, and he ran over a long, long distance. And he did so in a very sort of solitary manner. He didn't refer to anyone else in his decisions. He was not influenced by any particular individuals who persuaded him to do things. He arrived at his decisions alone. And I think that, in a way, the loneliness of a long-distance runner is what explains Oleg. He was and remains, in some ways, a very isolated figure. This was a decision, this was a race, if you like, that he decided he had to run alone.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Ben McIntyre, author of The Spy and the Traitor. In the book, McIntyre tells the thrilling story of the Cold War's greatest double agent. Among the many Russian secrets that Gordievsky sends back to the West, I think I read something in your book about the fact that he may have actually influenced or at least given Reagan and Thatcher information that led them to know that Russia, or Gorbachev anyway, was willing to either bring down the wall or head toward perestroika, however you want to describe it. I wonder if you could clarify that for us.
Well, yes. I mean, it's a generalization, but spies on the whole don't necessarily make an enormous amount of difference to the course of history. I mean, that's a bold statement, but on the whole, spies, if they're good, may keep us safer. They will inform, as it were, regular diplomats of the secret story that may be going on. But do they change history? Not very often. Oleg Gordievsky is different. He really did change the course of history. Let me give you just two examples of that. One of the things that he brought to the British and therefore to the Americans at the same time, because everything that Oleg was producing for MI6 was being passed to the CIA, which is how Aldrich Ames learned about it. And one of the things that he revealed was that the Soviet leadership genuinely believed that the West was about to launch a first strike. The men in the Kremlin, the sort of the ancient gerontocracy that was running the Kremlin, genuinely believed that the West was the aggressor. Now, when this was revealed to, I'm simplifying here, when this was revealed to Reagan and Thatcher, both of them were extremely shocked. They'd always seen the Soviet Union as the attacking party. And all that rhetoric that came out of the White House at that point about the evil empire and so on was informed by Reagan's belief that it was the Kremlin was going to attack. Actually, what Oleg was able to reveal was it was the other way around. There was a danger that by continuing this kind of ferocious rhetoric, actually, Reagan and Thatcher were going to trigger precisely the kind of thing they were trying to avoid. And you can see a clear grading down, a clear kind of blunting of the rhetoric from the moment that Oleg produced that. But let me give you the other example, which is very telling, I think, which is that Gorbachev, the rising star of the Politburo, the young hope, the man that, you know, the West thought was going to produce great things, arrived for a visit to Britain in December 1984. Now, it was his first visit abroad. It was the first time he'd been welcomed in the West. And one of the jobs that Oleg, who was then in the KGB station in London, was given was to produce briefing notes for Gorbachev on what he should say to Margaret Thatcher when they met. And he produced this. But of course, these briefing notes were actually being dictated to him by MI6. So you've got an extraordinary situation here where one spy is briefing both sides. He was telling Gorbachev what to say to Thatcher and Thatcher what she should say to Gorbachev. So, not surprisingly, those meetings went exceptionally well. I mean, they ended up getting on extremely well. At the end of it, Margaret Thatcher famously wrote to Ronald Reagan saying, Gorbachev is a man we can do business with. Now, well, one of the reasons why they could do business with him, and why one of the reasons why Perestroika and Glasnost and so on followed, one of the reasons they could do business was because Oleg Gordievsky was informing both sides. He was rigging the business.
You know, to your point about how spies don't necessarily turn global events, it is interesting to see some incredible photos you have in your book, more than one with Prime Minister Thatcher, but also one of Gordievsky in the White House with President Reagan, having his
photo taken. I mean, this is a man whose spy craft was so excellent that the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Britain knew this guy, knew about him, and actually met him.
Absolutely. I mean, they were both intensely and rightly grateful to Gordievsky, who really was, I mean, for a period, he was the most important source of information from inside the Soviet Union. He was able to tell the West not just what the KGB was doing, but what the KGB was thinking of doing. And that allowed the West to remain, in many instances, you know, two steps ahead of the opposition. If you know what is going on inside your opponent's mind, you're in pre-poll position. And I think both Reagan and Thatcher appreciated that only Gordievsky did this at immense risk. I mean, the dangers for only Gordievsky were not simply that he might be arrested. Had he been captured, and he very nearly was, had he been caught, he would have been interrogated, he would have been tortured, and he would have been shot. So the stakes could not have been higher, and I think both the President and the Prime Minister realized just the extent of the risk that he had run.
I'm not so sure I completely understood what a full-blown spy or counter-spy Gordievsky was until I read the part in your book where you said he didn't even trust his own wife. And I would like you to comment, not necessarily on that as much as the impact his spy craft, his spy career had on family.
Well, I mean, this is, in a way, the emotional core of this book, really. I mean, Oleg adored his wife. He loved her very much, but he didn't trust her. He couldn't trust her, he always maintained, with his biggest secret. She was herself the daughter of two KGB, senior KGB officials. You know, she was part of the system that he was trying to destroy. So he was in a kind of, in a way, he was in an appalling position of his own making. The person he loved most in the world was also the person he was most directly deceiving. And he faced a terrible decision. He had to make a decision about when he realized he was in deep trouble, that the KGB was onto him. He had to decide whether or not he could tell his own wife what he had actually been, that instead of being this loyal KGB officer that she thought he was, that in fact, for a dozen years, he had been spying for the other side. When that moment came, it was really was, and in many ways still is, the dark night of Oleg Gordievsky's soul. That was the moment when he had to make this terrible decision, and he decided that he couldn't trust her. He had to try to escape alone.
So before we get to the escape, tell us what happens to him when he's called back to Russia, put under questioning. And the question I have is, how come that KGB truth serum didn't work?
Well, it's a very good question. I think the short answer to your last question is that truth serum doesn't really work.
I see.
I mean, there's no real example of it ever working properly. The Russians had much more faith in it than they should have done. They also believed it caused a kind of amnesia, so he would never remember that the truth drug had been administered. I mean, what happened was he got back to Moscow. He went to his apartment, wondering whether he was safe. He tried to open the door of his apartment, and he realized that a lock on the door that he never used had been locked, which must mean, he calculated, that the KGB had been inside his apartment, and he was absolutely right. And they began to follow him. They put him under very close surveillance. I think the theory from the Soviet side was that they were trying to catch him. They were trying to trap him, making contact with his Western case officers. They wanted to thoroughly embarrass MI6 by getting Oleg in flagrante. So they just followed him. And also they didn't believe anyone could escape from the Soviet Union. So they followed him around. And as you say, at one point, to try to get him to confess, they took him to a dacha and fed him Armenian brandy laced with sodium pentothal, this supposed truce drug. But in fact, Oleg managed to resist that. He didn't confess. But what that did was it demonstrated to him that he really was under really in serious danger and that he had to get out. Mm-hmm. So, but that game of cat and mouse extraordinarily lasted for over 2 months. While Oleg was supposedly on leave, he was actually being clacked by the KGB and he had to throw them off.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Ben McIntyre, author of The Spy and the Traitor. So tell us about the escape. How does he figure out he's going to get out of here, and what role does MI6 play in this?
Well, many years earlier, MI6 had framed an escape plan for Gordievsky called Operation Pimlico, which was a rather extravagant idea that if Oleg could get himself to a particular lay-by south of the Finnish border with the Soviet Union at a particular time of day on a Saturday, that two diplomatic cars from the British Embassy, driven by MI6 officers, would pick him up, try and drive him through the border, and hope that the diplomatic convention by which diplomatic cars are not searched at borders would enable them to smuggle him out of the Soviet Union. It was an incredibly long shot. It was very, very unlikely to work. And first of all, Oleg had to have some way of signalling to MI6 that he was that the escape plan needed to be activated. And believe it or not, the way that they were going to do that, according to the plan, was that if Oleg was seen standing on a particular corner of a particular street in Moscow at 7:30 on a Tuesday night, holding, believe it or not, a bag from Safeway supermarket, that would be the indication that he needed to get out. And if they saw it, MI6 officers would go down to the signal site. They would walk past Oleg Gordievsky. They would make brief eye contact. And at that point, they would take out a Mars bar from their pocket and eat it. That was going to be the acceptance signal. I mean, it sounds like something that John le Carré might have made up.
Exactly.
It probably is.
That's just what I was thinking. I mean, this is too good to be true, but it is true. So one more thing about spycraft. At one point, I don't know whether it's in your book or an interview I heard with you on the book, you referred to Oleg Gordievsky as a champion dry cleaner. Help us understand what that is.
Well, in Russian spy jargon, espionage jargon, the word for surveillance evasion, or being able to throw off a tail, is proverbka, the Russian word, which literally means dry cleaning. It's a sort of slang term. So you know, Oleg, believe it or not, was trained in a special spy school outside Moscow. As a young man, as a young intelligence officer, he was trained in proverbka, in dry cleaning, and he was very, very good at it. There was no one better, in fact, at spotting whether he was being followed, evading whoever was trying to follow him, but critically, without the people following him realizing that was what he was doing. The key to proverbka is to throw off a tail, but in such a way that the tail believes they've made their own mistake, that they haven't, you know, that they're not being shaken off. Because obviously, if they realize they are being shaken off, they'll realize that the person they're tailing is onto them. And so that's why Oleg was, as I said, a champion dry cleaner, which stood him in extraordinarily good stead.
So how does Oleg physically get out of Russia?
Okay, on July the 15th, 1985, he managed to throw off, to dry clean himself of the surveillance team that was following him. He got to the corner of the signal site carrying his Safeway bag. It was acknowledged by MI6. The whole escape operation rolled into action. He managed to get himself up to this particular lay-by that had been identified to him as the place where the pickup would take place. At the same time, the two MI6 cars set off, trying to make sure that they could also throw off their KGB tail. They were also being followed. I mean, in the end, it came down to an operation of about 80 seconds. They had 80 seconds to get into the lay-by, drag Oleg out of the bushes where he'd been hiding, wrap him in a special heat-reflecting blanket, which they hoped would ward off the infrared cameras that they knew were operating at the Soviet border, stuff him in the boot, and then get back on the road before the KGB realized that they'd lost them. And that whole operation took about 80 seconds.
And that is how he managed to get past the border, because he had this special blanket around him and they didn't detect
him?
Yes,
he did. I mean, it was a really long shot. I mean, in lots of ways, it shouldn't have worked. I mean, luck plays, as it always does in these stories, luck plays an enormous part. He got across the border in some ways due to the very quick thinking of the wives of the MI6 officers who were driving the car. At one point, they were crossing the border and they got to the second barrier on the border without being detected. But the sniffer dogs, the Soviet border guard sniffer dogs, had clearly detected that something was in the boot of one of these cars, and they'd begun to sniff their way around the boot. And at that point, one of the wives of the senior MI6 officer took her little baby, who was in the back seat of the car, and took off her nappy, believe it or not, a dirty diaper that the baby was wearing, and dropped it under the boot of the car. And the smell of that disguised, wafted up, and they believe disguised the smell of the human body that was in the boot of that car, and the dogs backed off. So in a way, that's the dirty diaper that changed the course of the Cold War.
Well, as you pointed out at the beginning of our conversation here, Ben, Oleg still lives in London. He's under 24-hour guard, heavily protected. And, of course, at the conclusion of your book, you mention what happens to some former KGB folks who get poisoned in London. We've read reports of that lately. And so it does raise the concern level as far as this gentleman is concerned. I guess the question I have, you say he has a new name, he's living anonymously in some neighborhood in London, but now thousands of people pick up your book, they read the book, they listen to you tell this story. There's not too many anonymous people living in London who have a 24-hour bodyguard, and it's like, how long does it take for somebody to figure out after reading your book that this guy next door to him who is always leaving? Well, he's not always leaving the house, I guess. You can tell us about that. But who has somebody looking after him all the time, maybe none other than Oleg. What do you think?
Well, the short answer, and I won't go into details because I can't, but Oleg Gordievsky is very, very safe.
Oh, okay.
Let me just put it that way.
Yeah.
It would always have been extremely difficult to get to him. I would say it is now virtually impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And there is nothing in the book that really could lead you to his physical whereabouts. He is as safe now as he's ever been. But, you know, there is a risk. I mean, that one shouldn't be sort of nonchalant about it. I mean, when Oleg escaped from Moscow, he was tried in absentia by a KGB court. He was found guilty of treachery, and he was sentenced to death. And that sentence has never been lifted. It is still in place. So at least theoretically, mm-hmm. Oleg lives and has always lived ever since his escape to the West under a death sentence. Now, he's a man, in some ways, a rather solitary figure, a rather lonely man, but he is also one of the bravest people I've ever met. And though he has lived in this strange life, you could call it a life in a way of captivity, I have never heard him express a single word of regret for what he did, let alone a word of fear. Oleg Gordievsky doesn't really do fear.
Your book wouldn't be possible were it not for the cooperation you received, first, of course, and most importantly, from Oleg Gordievsky, but also the countless other people who you give credit to, both in the book, in the footnotes, and in the acknowledgments. But I'd like to focus for a moment on the role that memory plays here, especially Gordievsky's memory and the way he was trained as a KGB spy, and why, in the end, it perhaps is KGB training that makes your book as good as it could possibly be.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so. I mean, the answer is that Oleg's memory was trained. I mean, as a young KGB officer, they were taught to memorize vast amounts of material. And that is what makes Gordievsky, really, in my experience, a unique source, because you can ask him a question about what it smelled like in a particular room of a particular office in Moscow in 1962. Not only will he be able to tell you, but if you ask him the same question 2 years later, he'll tell you exactly the same thing. It's not only a prodigiously wide memory, it's an extraordinarily accurate memory. And so that really is the sort of underpinning of all of this, is that in the dozens of hours that I spent with Oleg Gordievsky, he was able to really give one a sort of blow-by-blow, almost hour-by-hour sometimes account, not just of what he was doing, but also what he was feeling. And that is also true, in a way, of the case officers involved. Intelligence officers, the sources that I spoke to, particularly the sort of dozen or so MI6 officers that ran Oleg Gordievsky, were astonishingly consistent in what they remembered. That enabled one to write with considerable authority about what actually happened. These people didn't contradict each other all that much. And I think they were all peculiarly honest with me. Memory is a fickle thing. We all remember in different ways. We all have our own myths about our own past. I found I didn't really find very much of that in this story, but there's a surprising level of consistency throughout.
Well, Ben, this morning I tweeted, if truth is stranger than fiction, Ben McIntyre's The Spy and the Traitor is the best example. You've done a marvelous job here. This is a must-read for our listeners at Reader's Corner, and I just want to thank you from sharing this half hour with us all the way from London, England. Thanks for being with us today at Reader's Corner.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.